On the program today, businesses, big and small, and the state of this economy in these stressful times. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Riznell. It is Tuesday, today the 12th day of January. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. We're going to give a nod as we get going to the place of businesses in the politics of this economy right now. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a usually reliable supporter of conservative and Republican politicians, said today, not so fast. There are some members that by their actions, and this is a quote, will have forfeited the support of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, period, full stop. That's from Neil Bradley. He's the chief policy officer at the chamber. We've had him on the program. At that same news conference, Chamber President Tom Donahue said President Trump, and this is another quote, undermined our democratic institutions and ideals. Smaller businesses, the ones that support most of the jobs in this economy, aren't feeling so great about things either. A survey out this morning from the National Federation of Independent Business showed their confidence is at seven-month lows. Fewer of them are looking to expand. Sales forecasts are down. And despite the fact that borrowing money is really cheap right now, because money is basically free, hello, low interest rates, only 3% of those small businesses say they have any desire to take on more debt. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going with that one.
Back in 2018, Sophie Blake took out a business loan for her Virginia-based jewelry store because, she says, she was feeling good about the economy.
And I was very aggressive. I was very excited. We did a big renovation of our store. I felt confident enough at the time that we would be able to pay it back.
Right now, she's not so confident. Blake's store now has a government disaster loan on its books, and it's borrowed from the Paycheck Protection Program. Blake says the idea of taking out a loan to expand her business, like she did in 2018, is out of the question.
I'm not sure if we're going to be around at the end of the year if things go the way they're going.
And that's why most businesses don't want to borrow any money right now, says Bill Dunkelberg, chief economist at the NFIB. There are some companies taking advantage of the lowest interest rates we've seen in a long time.
The banks that I'm familiar with are doing a lot of lending to small construction firms to build, you know, one or two or three new houses, some bigger construction projects like the Dunkin' Donuts or small hotels.
At the Bank of Southern California, CEO Nathan Raggi has been looking to make loans to businesses in other industries.
Industries that are associated with the internet, anything that's medical. We're looking at distribution, wholesalers, all doing relatively well.
Raggi says those are all businesses that have valuable collateral and pretty solid cash flow, considering two things a lot of other businesses don't have right now. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
The American labor market in this 10th month of this pandemic is struggling. Lost 140,000 jobs last month. We learned that this past Friday. But how about the labor market yet to come? From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
This time of year typically sees a spike in hiring and job search activities, says Jill Chapman with Insperity Recruiting Services.
Fresh start, new year, let's kick it off.
But that kind of optimistic planning for the future isn't really the vibe these days.
So I think that we're still in that, let's just take a pause, let's just look, let's just wait. We're all just collectively holding our breath.
That sense of unease was reflected in lagging job postings at the end of the year, says Jed Kolko, chief economist with job search site Indeed.
Recovery is not happening as quickly as it had been earlier in 2020.
Job listings are down about 11% compared to a year ago, concentrated in industries directly hit by the pandemic, like tourism and restaurants, but also in sectors like tech and finance.
That's not because those sectors are doing worse in the pandemic. Instead, those higher wage sectors tend to make longer term decisions.
So they're looking at the economic picture months or even years into the future. And it's still pretty murky, says Andy Challenger at staffing firm Challenger Gray and Christmas.
The economy has been racked with unbelievable uncertainty, both because of the pandemic, but also a large amount of political uncertainty.
And that, to state the obvious, seems likely to be the case for some time to come. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday. I mean, sometimes you just want to say to them, hey, read the room, will ya? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's not a lot of space in New York City for supersized grocery stores, so a lot of New Yorkers rely on smaller convenience stores called bodegas. They're on almost every corner. They sell groceries and toilet paper, batteries, and these days also face masks. There are about 15,000 of them, and they have been designated essential businesses for the duration of this thing. But even so, a lot of them are struggling. Marketplace Jasmine Garst paid a visit to a bodega owner up in the Bronx, whom she first met by phone back in April.
When Francisco Marte was a teenager, a friend of his family offered him a job at a bodega in the Bronx, saying, you can have it if you can survive it.
I said to him on the spot, sure, give it to me.
It's hard to imagine Marte as a tough guy. He's now in his 50s with a sweet, mischievous smile. But back then, he got robbed, beaten, and has even been shot. He made it. And what Marte says he learned in the process is that the bodega is about more than getting a cheap coffee, a box of cereal. The bodega is and always has been about survival and community.
We are the listeners. A lot of people come with their problems to talk to the bodega guy.
On this weekday morning, Marte is behind the counter holding court with customers whose jackets are so puffy they can barely get through the narrow store aisles, which have been hard to keep stocked.
There was a time when I couldn't even get toilet paper or napkins. Now they only give each bodega 5 packs at a time.
As of a few months ago, parts of the Bronx experienced unemployment higher than 20%. Sales at the bodega have just plummeted. Soon, a young Dominican man named Leo Mejia stops by.
Francisco.
He's a distributor, among other things, of Coco Rico, a Puerto Rican soda. Mejia looks gaunt under the fluorescent lights, and he tells me it's his first day back on the job after having COVID-19.
I still can't smell things. Everything tastes like salt.
Mejia says he was surprised to find that 4 of the bodegas he used to deliver to have shut down, a problem since he earns on commission.
There's bodegas that haven't asked for service in over a month.
While we speak, a man in a wheelchair bursts through the door, excited.
They're giving a stimulus out.
Gregory Manning, a regular, has just gotten his $600 stimulus payment. But that money, he says, is not going to be spent at the bodega.
Basically, everybody's going to be paying bills. Ain't nobody's going to be buying nothing new.
As the guys celebrate, an older man walks in. He asks to speak to Marte privately.
You're my brother, man.
After he leaves, Marte tells me the man asked him for a $20 loan. He says this is happening more often. So is what's called dar de fiao, or putting it on the tab.
I won't give a beer or cigarettes or stuff like that. But if it's milk, a soda, something to eat, yes, I'll put it on your tab. These are people I've known for a long time.
Bodegas are often micro-loan institutions. For Marte, it comes at a cost. He's lost a lot of income. The elementary school next door is temporarily closed. The gym across the street is empty. He's let go of most of his employees and had to rely on a $22,000 PPP loan. The Partnership for New York City estimates that roughly 1/3 of the city's small businesses may not survive the pandemic. But it's not all doom and gloom. Marte urges me to stay a while because at night, this bodega moonlights as a sort of social club where neighbors meet for beers and dance. Armando Poveda, an Ecuadorian taxi driver, tells me he used to drive people to work on Park Avenue, but that's mostly dried up. For him, one of the hardest parts of the pandemic is
I knew loneliness, an ugly loneliness.
He's months behind in rent. He's worried. But he says here, on aisle 2, for a moment in time, it's not just you surviving by yourself. In the Bronx, I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Just because being the biggest retailer in the world isn't big enough, Walmart is expanding. Pet insurance, that's for reals. A growing array of human health services. Walmart Plus, its Amazon Prime competitor. Also now, banking. The company is partnering with Ribbit Capital, the investment firm behind Robinhood and Credit Karma and Affirm, to build a fintech startup. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab now on why Walmart wants to give its customers an alternative to traditional banks.
Let's get something out of the way here. Walmart's expansion into banking isn't about banking. It's about keeping people loyal to the brand.
The biggest benefit of getting into this venture is to strengthen its position in retailing.
Ji Zhang, a professor of marketing and retail at the University of Maryland, says the company might encourage spending through extra discounts, rebates, and rewards. And Walmart already has two core groups to start with. Group one, it's 2.2 million employees. Group two, existing shoppers.
Walmart's core customer base primarily consists of low to middle income households. Some of them don't own a regular bank account.
That's 6% of households, according to the U.S. government. Walmart already serves some of these customers with check cashing, money orders, and debit cards. Greg McBride is an analyst with Bankrate.com. He says the sheer size of Walmart's footprint and customer base means it can offer prices major banks don't.
One thing we can know for sure, it will be low cost.
That might mean low to no account minimums or overdraft fees. But Lisa Servan, author of The Unbanking of America, says affordable services won't be enough. The biggest challenge for Walmart will be trust.
And whether they can transfer that trust over to financial services, whether that kind of migrates.
That's what Walmart is betting on, hoping people want to bank where they already get their groceries, pet care, and prescriptions. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Two quick things before we go on. Number one, Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow, early. Check it out. You won't be disappointed. Also, number two, if you miss us on the air for some reason, which I can't imagine why, but if you did, try our podcast, would you? Coming up.
And so then it was just like having to give all of that up.
A lose-lose situation, you might say. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials found 60 points in the couch cushions, about a tenth percent, 31,068. The NASDAQ added 36 points, about two-tenths percent, 13,072. The S&P 500 basically flat, 38-1 there. Justin took a look at what it might take to help the business sector. A recent Brookings study suggested one way to foster overall economic growth. Overall economic growth is to help Black-owned businesses that Brookings found comprise only about 2% of the nation's 5.7 million companies with more than one employee. Only 4.2% of Black-owned businesses have employees in this economy. That's compared to more than 20% of white-owned companies. Kristen Schwab was telling us about Walmart developing its own fintech venture. Walmart added 1.1% today. Bonds up, yields down 1.13%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talked about businesses up at the top of the program, the bigger ones represented by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and smaller ones that Justin was talking about, and where they are with this corona economy, which is mostly not in a great place. That's all the more true for businesses owned and run by minorities. Today for us, agriculture, specifically Black agriculture. Cornelius Blanding is the executive director of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives Land Assistance Fund. Mr. Blanding, thanks for coming on, sir.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
For those who are not familiar, give us the 30-second spiel on your group and your members.
We're simply a cooperative association of Black farmers, landowners, and cooperatives all around the South. Our primary goals are providing cooperative economic development, land retention, and advocacy for our members.
So how has economic development been going for your members the last, 9 months or so as this economy has gone through what it's gone through?
We've been challenged like everybody else in this country, everybody else in this world. We've had farmers, we've had cooperatives who've lost a lot of business because of the pandemic, like many people. But it's been on top of a number of record years of losses. But with every disaster, there's some opportunities. And so there have been some opportunities to cooperate better, but it's been a challenge.
Yeah, I hear you. I want to ask you about one of the aid programs from the Department of Agriculture, the food box program, where the government would, in essence, buy produce from you know, all farmers, but including your members, and distribute it to families in need. That worked for a while for y'all, but then kind of stopped, right?
Yes. The food box program for us, it was a godsend. It was the kind of program that we needed, something that could have been built upon. We were able to buy food directly from our membership, from Black farmers who otherwise would have lost income. And we were able to supply that food directly to the communities that needed the most. And it was a direct relationship. But then, as you know, this program started to change. They started leaning back toward large agriculture, large corporations. And when it started morphing, those farmers started being left out.
So we did a lot of work on this program in the summer and fall after George Floyd about the systemic racism in this economy. And we talked about, you know, big companies, Fortune 500 companies, and we talked about the economics profession and academia. I'm just going to throw out here that my guess would be that there's systemic racism in Black agriculture, too.
Your guess would be right. There's a reason that there's so few Black farmers. In 1910, there were 218,000 Black farmers, and they owned roughly 15 million acres of land. For the turn of the century, according to the 1992 census, there were only 18,000 Black farmers with a little over 2 million acres of land. And so you're talking about an enormous loss of land, an enormous loss of farmers. And so that isn't by accident. Those are some things where there's some issues that are in the system.
You probably travel a lot, right, Mr. Blanding?
I do.
Yeah. So when you go out and you talk to your members and you sit down and you have a cup of coffee or maybe a beer or a drink after work or whatever it is, do your members and your clients, do they understand these problems and see them? Or are they just too busy working the land to pick their head up and I guess, think about big picture?
There's a broad range. There are some who do understand what's happening to them. There's some who see this in simple black and white terms. Yeah. They know they're getting less for their crops than their white neighbor down the street is getting for his crop.
Say that again. Racism and discrimination in pricing.
Yes.
Because of the race of the farmer.
Exactly. So they know that they get a smaller price for their goods than their neighbor down the streets. And many times it's because their neighbor down the street talks with them. They know that. And as a matter of fact, Kai, our organization is a 54-year-old organization. It was founded by 22 cooperatives. We've had co-ops in Mississippi that knew they got less for their collard greens than their neighbor did. So they had to form a cooperative so that they can ship their products to Chicago to get a better price. That's been a reality for Black farmers for centuries.
Well, Mr. Blanding, thanks for your time, sir. That's Cornelius Blanding. He's the executive director of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives Land Assistance Fund. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
This pandemic has been hard on all of us, yes. It has been especially hard, though, on women. Of the 140,000 jobs this economy lost last month, women accounted for all of them. All of them. And for moms juggling work and childcare, the situation is especially bad. Marketplace's Rima Kreis is the host of our podcast, This is Uncomfortable.
Just weeks before the pandemic hit, Tiara Noblin had landed what felt like a dream job. It was a healthcare coordinator position making $50,000, about $15,000 more than her last job. And as a single mom raising two daughters, she says that was huge.
It was just like, oh my God, I can actually pay all my bills in the full amount. And if my kids wanted McDonald's every day, I can do that.
But then, you know, the pandemic happened. And suddenly, Tiara was working remotely, stuck at home with her 17-year-old daughter and her 5-year-old, who was struggling.
She was really restless. She was really angry.
Her school went virtual, and as a kid with autism, disruptions in routine can be really tough. Tiara remembers one morning in April when her daughter was having an especially bad day.
oh, it's a full body on the floor, flailing, just screaming, crying.
Meanwhile, Tiara had been in the middle of job training during this meltdown.
And of course, I had to meet with my supervisor, and I forgot that I had left my Zoom up. And so she came on, and so she's hearing everything.
Oh, my God.
So finally, she yells, and she's like, hey, I'm here, you know, just to let you know, I hear everything. I'm so sorry. Don't worry about it.
It wasn't a great look. The pandemic has been especially tough on working moms. One researcher, Amy Knopp from Indiana University, surveyed dozens of moms, and she found that those in partnerships tended to take on the bulk of childcare responsibilities, even when their partners weren't working.
For me, the biggest takeaway is the extent to which women are blaming themselves for their stresses with their children, for their perceived failures at work and at parenting.
According to the Census Bureau, a third of women considered to be in the prime working age but are not working said it was due to childcare demands. And the longer they're out of the workforce, the harder it can be to stay competitive or get promotions. In fact, research shows that more women leaving their jobs could mean the gender pay gap growing even larger.
The real story for me is the extent to which women are not told that structural issues are in fact what is happening. This is not a personal failure.
She says structural issues like unequal pay, little to no paid maternity leave, and the lack of affordable childcare. For Tiara, taking care of her 5-year-old during the workday started to feel impossible. Before long, she was rescheduling meetings with her boss, missing phone calls, missing deadlines.
There was no way that I could keep this up and still be a good mom. There was no way that I could keep this up and still be a good employee.
Then, a few months into the job, Tiara had a meeting with her supervisor.
And I had already had this speech set up like, yeah, this is not working. But she beat me to the punch.
As gently as she could, her supervisor let her go.
I was finally building my savings back up. Like, life was comfortable. Life was good. And so then it was just like having to give all of that up.
Tiara isn't sure what's next for her and her family. Right now, she's getting $400 a week on unemployment, but that expires in February. To save money, she canceled her cable, and lately, she and her daughters have been eating mostly pasta, chicken, and rice.
I felt guilty. It was definitely that thought of like, oh my God, did I just mess up my kids' future? Did I mess up my own future after I got to a good place?
But she's become sure of one thing. When it comes down to her work performance versus her family,
it was almost a no-brainer. Like, I would definitely pick my family over a job anytime.
But really, she says it also feels like a no-win situation. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
Lots more on how working mothers are being hit by this pandemic on This Is Uncomfortable. You can subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. Also, if your experience is similar to Tiara's, we want to hear from you. Send us your story at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today. Possibly this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us, but leeway will be given because pandemic. This year, you'll be able to get your Girl Scout cookies via Grubhub. Makes sense, right? No office kitchen for parents to leave the sign-up sheets in. Tough to do tables outside supermarkets in a pandemic, right? The good news and the faith in humanity and business with a conscience moment here is that Grubhub is going to waive its fees. All right, we're out of here, but here is your Tuesday moment of economic context, Federal Reserve edition. Little known fact about the Fed, it's required to fund itself from the proceeds of its market operations, the buying and selling of bonds that it holds and interest payments it makes and receives. And then it has to send whatever is left over to the Treasury Department, the general fund. Anyway, in 2020, thanks mostly to low interest rates, the Fed turned a net profit of $88.5 billion. How about that? Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufukme Madolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.